Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the origin of public schools right after this. Well, back in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." That clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there is no difference in the value of gold and silver coin when compared to clad coin and currency, and that's true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there is a 7-to-1 difference in purchasing power of gold over paper, and a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes due on that paper over gold. That's why God and our founding fathers gave us gold and silver coin for a purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, our Congress and politicians didn't take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away their gold and silver coin. In order to take away the people's right to property and destroy their property rights. So if we intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation of all liberty. Now let me teach you how to do just that. My business school is now on compact disc for adult home school. For more information about my private business school, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's informative, entertaining, educational, and it's free. You can call right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Remember, my business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email, send an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about poison drops in the federal Senate, a book written in 1886 by Zach Montgomery, who had been appointed by President Grover Cleveland as the Assistant Attorney General of the United States. He was not confirmed by the Congress because of his views on public schools, and these are those views. In Chapter 2, 3, and 4, we took a look at crime and suicide. We found that nationally, from 1850 to 1880, that concurrent with the increased expenditures on public education over that 30-year period, there was a concurrent increase in crime and suicide in the states that had adopted public education. From 1850 to 1880, not all of the states adopted public education. Some states had retained parental education, two forms of education, state and parental. Now, parental education is that form of education that goes back to Moses and the Mosaic Law, and those standards set down by God at Mount Sinai, 4 statutes that regulate educating your children. In the United States, about the mid-19th century, the progressives began to clamor for a public school system, a system like the Germans and the Europeans had. Now, long before the mid-19th century, in fact, 200 years before, Massachusetts had adopted this European system, this Babylonian system. They went back into ancient times. That's where the government, the king, educates your child. Southern states like Virginia, Georgia, North and South Carolina, Maryland, and Delaware had adopted the parental system or had retained the parental system. And in that system, we saw during that 30 years, the rates of pauperism, insanity, crime, were all much lower than they were in the states that had adopted public education. Now let's take a look at insanity. That's insane, idiots, blind, and deaf mutes as a class of persons from 1850 to 1880, Chapter 5. Well, Mr. Fred H. Wines, he was the special census agent. In his preface to the statistics of crime, pauperism, insanity for 1880, presents the following synopsis of the number of insane, idiots, blind, and deaf mutes found in the United States during the years 1880, 1870, 1860, and 1850, respectively. Here is that table. The totals in 1880, 250,000. The totals in 1870, 100,000. The totals in 1860, 68,000, and 1850, 50,000. So they went from 1850 and 50,000 to 70,000 10 years later to 100,000 in 1870 and jumped from 100,000, 250% to 250,000 by 1880. As remarked by the agent, the total population for each of these years was as follows. 1850, the population of the United States, 23 million. 1860, 31 million. 1870, 38 million. 1880, 50 million. In other words, while the population has only a little more than doubled in 30 years, the number of defective persons returned is nearly five times as great as it was 30 years ago. So you find here that from 1850 to 1880, a period of 30 years, the defectives in society grow by 500% while the population doubles or goes up by 100%. What caused that? Well, as shown elsewhere, it's also painfully apparent that our criminals have increased almost in the exact same ratio with the increase of our insane, idiotic, and other defective classes. And during the past decade, or since 1870, the increase in population has been 30%, but the apparent increase in the defective classes has been a little more than 150% in that 10-year period. In commenting on the astounding growth of crime, insanity, pauperism, etc. in the United States during the last 30 years, the special agent goes on to say, quote, "The interest and importance of the inquiry into the number and condition of the defective classes and of the criminal and pauper population arises from the fact that these are burdens to be borne, drains upon the vitality of the community. When we consider the growth of our population and our material resources, we are in danger of forgetting that there is another side to the picture. It is startling to know that of 50 million people, over 400,000 are either insane, idiots, deaf, mutes, or blind, or inmates of prisons, reformatories, or poorhouses. If to these we add the outdoor poor and the inmates of private charitable institutions, the number will swell to nearly or quite half a million, or 1% of the total population." Now, we italicize and fully endorse the closing words of the agent in which he says, quote, "We cannot begin too soon or prosecute too vigorously the inquiry into the causes of the prevalence of these evils, which are like a canker at the heart of all of our prosperity. Nothing can be more important than for us to ascertain at the earliest possible moment the rate at which they are increasing and the means of arresting their growth." Now, the subject is obscure, says the agent, but in the study of it we may almost be said to have our finger upon the pulse of the nation, unquote. Now, while as suggested we fully endorse the said italicized words, we are not entirely disposed to endorse the declaration that the subject is an obscure one. especially to those who will carefully examine the statistics embodied in this report and then study them by the light of a few common sense principles. If it is true that a child brought up in the way that he should go will not depart from it when he is old, who then will venture to deny that there has been something radically wrong in the bringing up of a generation which so readily and so rapidly betakes itself to the paths of crime, for which, or which, either ignorantly or otherwise, brings upon itself the constantly increasing maladies of idiocy, insanity, and kindred evils? In 1880, our public school property was valued at $211 million. Our receipts during that 1 year for public school purposes reached the enormous sum of $100 million. There were gathered into our public schools nearly 10 million children, and out of our public school treasury, we were paying $55 million in the way of salaries to some 236,000 public school teachers in order to prevent crime, and to save the expenses of paying peace officers, and building city prisons, county jails, and state penitentiaries. And behold, what is the result? Our towns and cities swarm with policemen. Our prisons, our workhouses, our reformatories are crowded almost to suffocation with the thieves and robbers and the cutthroats, while gilded crime goes unpunished, and moneyed malefactors without number strut our streets with heads erect, spit upon the law, laugh justice to scorn, and fatten upon their ill-gotten millions, while multitudes of their wronged and ruined victims are lodged in almshouses, lunatic asylums, or seek refuge from so sad a fate in the still more horrid doom of self-destruction. Now, in Chapter 6, The Political Poison in the Public School Books, 10 millions of American children forced to drink daily, the deadly doctrine of centralization and despotism. Notice the term centralization. Well, today, big government is the apex of centralization. And he says, in our California public schools, as in those of most of the other states, Webster's Dictionary is the legally established authority for the definition of words. This would all be well enough if the Webster of today were the Webster of 25 years ago. But the illustrious and patriotic Noah Webster would blush in his grave at the thought of being made to father the bastard brood of political heresies which are now being taught in our public schools through the medium of a false, forged, and mutilated dictionary bearing his honored name. To show how the overthrow of constitutional liberty and the inestimable right of democratic self-government are being brought about by changing the meaning of words, a few examples should suffice. Now, take for example the word constitution. Webster's unabridged dictionary, as published in 1859, in giving the legal definition of the word constitution, says, quote, "In free states, the Constitution is paramount to the statutes or laws enacted by the legislature, limiting and controlling its power. And in the United States, the legislature is created and its powers designated by the Constitution." Unquote. But every word of the above definition is expunged from the Webster now used and required by law to be used in our public schools. And in its place, we find the following definition of the word constitution, to wit, quote, "The principal or fundamental laws which govern a state or other organized body of men and are embodied in written documents or implied in the institutions or usages of the country or society," unquote. Thus, under public school tuition, the rising generation no longer look upon the written Constitution as the source and the limit of legislative power. But on the contrary, the mere usages of society are now raised to the dignity of constitutional law. What a very convenient way of clothing official villainy in the garb of constitutional authority. After our corrupt and perjured officials have violated in 100 ways the Constitution they had solemnly sworn to support in order to carry out their nefarious schemes of fraud and plunder, how would it have been possible for them to have contrived a more ingenious device to justify in the eyes of the rising generation their official misdeeds than by thus adopting, legalizing, and forcing into the public schools the educational system through their willing tools a definition of the word constitution sufficiently elastic to cover every species of their accustomed rascalities? Again, the old Noah Webster of 25 years ago, in giving to the word union its political signification, defines it as states united. Thus, the United States of America are sometimes called the Union. But in the new false and mutilated Webster, which the public school system now forces our children to study, this definition is entirely suppressed, and in its place we have the word union defined as meaning, quote, a consolidated body as the United States of America, are often called the Union. Thus, while the real statesmen of both political parties are warning the people against the danger of a consolidated government, the children who are soon to take the places of these statesmen through our public school machinery are being indoctrinated with the idea that we already have a consolidated republic. In the case of McCulloch versus the state of Maryland, Chief Justice Marshall of the Supreme Court of the United States said, quote, no political dreamer was ever wild enough to think of breaking down the lines which separate the states and of compounding the American public into a solid mass, unquote. But what no political dreamer was ever wild enough to think of in Judge Marshall's time is now taught as an accomplished fact in our public schools. Again, Webster's Dictionary, 25 years ago, defined the word federal as, quote, consisting in a compact between parties, particularly and chiefly between states and nations formed on alliance by contract or mutual agreement as a federal government such as that of the United States, unquote. But the present public school Webster, after expunging every syllable of this definition, defines federal as being, quote, specifically composed of states, and which retain only a subordinate and limited sovereignty as the Union of the United States and the Sonderbund of Switzerland, unquote. Now, just a moment's reflection will show that under such a definition of the word federal, the several states composing the American Union would have no rights and no sovereignty which the general government would be bound to respect. Now, it is undoubtedly true that in all those matters in which, under the Constitution, the federal government has been clothed with sovereign authority and authority of the states is subordinate to the federal government. But in all things else or other than the sovereignty of the states is as supreme and as independent of the federal government, federal sovereignty, as if the federal sovereignty had never existed. In the celebrated Dred Scott case, the United States Supreme Court said, quote, the principles upon which our government rests and upon which alone they continue to exist is the union of states, sovereign and independent within their own limits in their internal and domestic concerns, unquote. But if, as now taught in our public schools of California and elsewhere, by these new definitions, the states have no sovereignty except such as is subordinate to the sovereignty of the United States, what becomes of our sovereign right to local self-government then? Suppose that the federal government should tomorrow, in the exercise of its supposed superior sovereignty, undertakes to nullify our state constitution and laws, abrogate our state government, remove from office our governor, abolish our state courts and our legislature, and force us to accept for our local government just such laws as the federal Congress might choose to give us, such state, county, and municipal officers as the president might send to rule over us. What remedy would we then have? Shall I be told that such action on the part of the federal government, clashing as it would with the principles of state sovereignty, would not be tolerated? But, I would answer, if a state possesses no sovereignty except such as is subordinate to the sovereignty of the federal government, would not our subordinate sovereignty be forced to yield to the superior sovereignty to which it is subordinate? Is it not a law of nature that whenever two unequal forces meet, the inferior must yield to the superior? Now, my countrymen, disguise the fact as we may, there is in this country today, and in both the political parties, an element which is ripe for a centralized despotism. There are men and corporations of vast wealth whose iron grasp spans this whole continent and who find it more difficult and more expensive to corrupt 30-odd state legislatures than it does one federal Congress. It was said of Nero of old that he wished the Roman people had but one head so that he might cut it off with a single blow. And so it is with those moneyed kings who would rule this country through bribery, fraud, and intimidation. It is easy to see how, with all of the powers of government centered in Washington, in one federal head, they could at a single stroke put an end to American liberty. But they well understand that before striking this blow, the minds of the people must be prepared to receive it. And what surer, what safer preparation could possibly be made than is now being made by indoctrinating the minds of our up-and-coming generation with the idea that ours is already a consolidated government, that the states of the Union have no sovereignty which is not subordinate to the will and pleasure of the federal head, and that our Constitution is the mere creature of custom and may therefore be legally altered or abolished by custom. Such are a few of the pernicious and poisonous doctrines which 10 million American children are today drinking in with the very definitions of the words that they are compelled to study. And yet the man who dares to utter a word of warning of the approaching danger is stigmatized as an enemy to education and unfit to be mentioned as a candidate for the humblest office. Well, be it so. Viewing this great question as I do, not for all of the offices in the gift of the American people would I shrink from an open and candid avowal of my sentiments on this subject. If I have learned anything from the reading of history, it is that the man who, in violation of great principles, toils for temporary fame, purchases for himself either total oblivion or eternal infamy, while he who temporarily goes down battling for right principles always deserves and generally secures the gratitude of succeeding ages and will carry with him the sustaining solace of a clean conscience more precious than all of the offices and honors in the gift of man. Now, history tells us that Aristides was voted into banishment because he was just. Yet, who would not 1,000 times rather today be Aristides than be numbered amongst the proudest of his persecutors? Socrates, too, in violation of every principle of justice, was condemned to a dungeon and to death. Yet, what name is more honored in history than Socrates? And which of his unjust judges would not gladly hide himself in the utter darkness of oblivion from the withering scorn and the contempt of all mankind, not to mention the judgment of God Almighty? From the noble examples of Aristides and of Socrates, let American statesmen learn wisdom, and from the undying infamy of their cowardly time-serving prosecutors and persecutors, let political demagogues of today take warning. Chapter 7. Now, mistakes of Catholics in dealing with this school question are numerous. The New York Catholic Review of November 26, 1881, published an able article on the education question taken from the Boston Journal of Education, and in commenting on the same, our Catholic contemporary, among other things, said, quote, "Let it always be borne in mind that we're in favor of free schools, provided they be fair," unquote. Now, this, of course, is an entirely safe proposition as stated, because everybody is supposed to be in favor of whatever is fair, as he understands the meaning of the word fair. But unfortunately, we're left in doubt as to what kind of free schools our esteemed contemporary Catholics would consider to be fair. Suppose, for example, that all of our public schools were such that every child in the land could be educated therein without any danger either to his health, life, morals, or religion. In other words, let us suppose that the public school system were otherwise perfect. Would it then be fair to make them free for all, and would the editor of the review be in favor of making them free for the children of the rich as well as for the children of the poor? And if he would, then we should like to have him answer one or two further questions, namely, does not every parent, by virtue of assuming the duties of the parental office, become bound by the natural law, the law of God, to feed and clothe and educate his own children? In other words, is it not the education of one's own children a just debt which, if able, he is morally bound to pay? And if the education of a child, his own child, a proper education is a debt which every parent, according to his ability, owes to his own children, upon what principle of fairness, then, or what principle of justice, then, can the state take one man's money with which to pay the debt of another man? Again, if feeding, clothing, and educating one's own children are all parental obligations with exactly the same origin, exactly the same standing upon precisely the same moral footing, and having identically the same binding force, then has not the state the very same right to feed and clothe that it has to educate at public expense the children of parents who are abundantly able to discharge these obligations? And if it is just and fair to raise by general taxation a common fund for the feeding, clothing, and education of all of the children in the country, why is it not equally just and fair to extend the same principle still further by compelling all to contribute to a common fund for the purpose of feeding and clothing everybody else, as well as everybody else's children? Again, is it fair that the poor old man and his decrepit wife, whom God has never blessed with children, but have to labor hard 16 hours a day, the former with his solitary horse and cart, and the latter over her washtub, in order to keep soul and body together, should be taxed to help educate the children of the millionaire who lives in all of the splendor of a prince? In other words, would it have been fair to levy upon the rags of Lazarus a tax to pay for educating the children of Dives? We do not now propose to discuss these questions, but shall await the answers thereto by the learned editor of the Catholic Review, and we hope that when we understand each other, we shall both be on the same side. After all, we both believe in doing that which is fair. Now, in commenting on the article quoted from the Boston Journal of Education, the editor of the Catholic Review, while referring to our present public school system, remarks that instead of being a bulwark, it is really a very great danger, as people know, and now that the Catholics have left off making so much noise about the matter, begin to see for themselves. The intimidation which seems to be conveyed by this remark is that agitation of the school question by Catholics necessarily tends to prevent non-Catholics from seeing or acknowledging the evils of the system. That there are some people so blinded by their antipathy to Roman Catholicism that they would not accept any truth upon Catholic authority. We do not doubt. But that the great body of non-Catholic Americans are the victims of so blind a bigotry, we do not believe, and our convictions are based upon some years of contact with people of all shades of religious and non-religious belief, from the strict followers of Knox and Calvin to the disciples of Thomas Paine, that there is a very general disposition among non-Catholics to distrust the motives of Catholics when agitating the school question is undoubtedly true. But for this distrust, we hold that Catholics are themselves very largely responsible. Now, the great evils of Catholics, or the great evils of the public school system, I should say, let me repeat that, the great evils of the public school system are such as affect not Catholics alone, but which strike at the authority of every parent, Catholic, Protestant, and Jew, and imperil the welfare and honor and the happiness of every family, no matter what his religious beliefs, and consequently any movement against this common foe should from the start have been in the name of and on behalf of the whole people and not for the benefit of only a small fraction of the people called Catholics. When the municipal authorities of New York City, more than 40 years ago, were appealed to for relief against the unjust exactions and cruel oppressions of this monstrous system, that appeal, as it seems to us, ought to have been in the name of the people of that city and for the benefit of the whole people of the city of New York. But instead of that, the petition prepared by, or under the auspices of, the illustrious Archbishop Hughes, which was expected to result in the securing their educational rights to a small portion of the inhabitants of that great metropolis, was headed thus to the Honorable the Board of Aldermen of the City of New York. The petition of the Catholics of New York respectfully represents. Well, let's take a little break right here. We'll put a mark here in the margin. And this is a book called Poison Drops in the Federal Senate. It's the story of the origin of the public schools of the United States. So let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and the law school is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publishers used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed are going to recommend or be recommended by us, or that they will reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and vice versa. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, news, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Zach Montgomery. He had been appointed as the assistant U.S. attorney, that is the, the attorney general. He would have been the assistant attorney general under Grover Cleveland in 1886, had he been confirmed by Congress, by the Senate. So instead, he said, well, let me write a book, and let me tell you where the bear does it and the rubber meets the road concerning this thing of public schools. And he got the statistics out from the Census Department and the government offices from 1850 to 1880, and he made a hell of a story here. Hell of a story. He made an observation. He said, there isn't any change in these numbers, and there are no exceptions where the public schools are concerned in 30 years, and I took a look, up through 1970, that was another 100 years, in looking at Jonas Yoder versus the state of Wisconsin, and the facts and figures that are being brought forth in 1886 are just as true, accurate, and correct today in 2005 as they were 130 years ago. I know it's a shocker, but listen to this. The petition then goes on to enumerate. Now, we're talking about the Catholics of New York City back in the 1880s. They said, hey, listen, you aldermen of you city council members in New York City, listen, we had a problem here between Catholicism, that is, our educational rights, and the public education. Zach Montgomery says that's a mistake to zero in or to single out Catholics. Everybody's in this game. Everybody's got the same amount to lose or to win, whether you're a Catholic, Protestant, or Jew. But anyway, the Catholics came to the aldermen. They said the petition then goes on to enumerate the hardships and the injustices which Catholics were suffering from the system, seemingly taking it for granted that it was good enough for the rest of mankind. To this it may be answered that Catholics had some grievances to complain of under the system which non-Catholics had not. This may be very true, but then it is equally true that underlying the whole system was a fundamental wrong which was sapping the foundation of family government and poisoning the very sources of all domestic happiness and threatening the downfall and ruin of all civil government and of the social order itself. And under these circumstances, it was seemingly as illy advised a movement for Catholics to make an isolated attack upon the system upon the sole ground of its antagonism to the Catholic faith as it would have been in revolutionary times for the Catholics of old Maryland to have declared war on Great Britain upon the sole ground that she was a Protestant power and imposed unjust burdens upon Catholics of the colony. And had the Catholics of those days raised such an issue as that and insisted upon their non-Catholic neighbors aiding them in fighting their battles upon such purely Roman Catholic grounds, instead of planting themselves upon the broad principles of human liberty, which were admittedly as dear to the Virginia Episcopalians and the New England Puritans as to themselves, how many recruits outside of their own borders would they have been able to raise for such a war? Here, then, we believe, was the first fatal mistake that the Catholics of this country fell into in fighting this school question, namely, the making of it a Roman Catholic question instead of a parental question. And from that day to this, a similar blunder has been periodically perpetrated, only on a smaller scale, in various parts of this country, invariably resulting in widening the breach between Catholics and non-Catholics on this education question. Another serious blunder, to call it by no harsher name, which many of our Catholics appear to us to have made, is the keeping up of a terrible cry about the godless public schools and the injustice of forcing Catholics to pay for their support whenever they're denied a share in the filthy lucre which pays the price of running these institutions, and then subsiding into the utmost docility and becoming perfectly reconciled to this demon of iniquity the moment they're allowed to pocket the price of the innocent souls which it sends to their destruction. Now, it should be obvious that one great reason why this class of Catholics, if they can be called such, have made so little impression upon the non-Catholic mind by the noise that they have made about the public school system, and this was because their course of conduct was not harmonized with their words. And a second reason is that there has not been and is not now any proper harmony between Catholics themselves. We find priests disagreeing with priests and laymen disagreeing with laymen on this vital question of the public school system. All this appears to us to arise from the fact of ignoring the great and fundamental principles of the natural law, the law of God, which makes it the right and the duty of fathers and mothers of all creeds and of no creed to direct and control the education of their own children according to the dictates of their own conscience. Now, this is a principle which is dear not only to the Catholic, but to the Protestant, the Jew, and the infidel as well. It's upon this platform that many of our best and ablest California minds, of all classes of religionists and of non-religionists, are beginning to take their stand. And we do not but simply want justice when we say that as a general rule, we have found Protestants and other non-Catholics as ready and oftentimes far more ready to take their stand with us upon this platform than were many of our co-religionists. Now, if we Catholics would make sure of non-Catholic assistance in our efforts to reform our public school system, we must first make sure that we ourselves are on the right road to such reform, and that our platform of principles is not only right, but broad enough to afford standing room for all child-loving parents, however widely they may differ from us on religious questions. But if Catholics themselves proclaim false principles, they ought not to find followers. That some very eminent Catholics have from time to time undertaken to maintain very erroneous theories touching this educational question seems to us undeniable. For example, we now have before us a book published in 1876 by the Catholic Publication Society of New York. It's entitled Catholics and Education, apparently intended to set forth the position occupied by Catholics on the much vexed school question. The book is made up of articles written by eminent Catholics and originally published in the Catholic World. The following lines from the preface explain the object of this publication. It says, quote, "The desire to understand the position of Catholics on this subject is widespread, and there is a demand among Catholics themselves for more abundant information. These considerations have induced the letter of the Catholic World, that is, the editor of the Catholic World, to reprint the following series of articles from the pages of that magazine," unquote. Now, one of these articles, which is thus given to the world as an explanation of the position of Catholics on the subject of public schools, at page 92, it contains the following. Quote, "We are decidedly in favor of free public schools for all of the children of the land, and we hold that the property of the state should educate the children of the state." Now, for one, we most solemnly protest against the soundness of this so-called Catholic position on the school question, and we maintain that it is both communistic and pagan. And we totally deny that the state has any children. It is true that by a fiction of the law in use in England, bastard children are sometimes called the children of the people. And if the writer of the article from which the above extract is taken intends to say that the property of the state should bear this burden of educating the state's bastard children, we shall urge no particular objection. But when the question arises, what is the property of the state? Surely it is not the property of the private citizen. If the state owns all of the property which we have heretofore supposed belong to individual citizens, the reign of communism has already begun. If, as seems to be claimed, the state owns all the children and all the property also, we can see no good reason why she may not and ought not, in common fairness, to make an equal distribution of her own property amongst her own children. After all, this is the true theory upon which rests this communistic system of public schools. Now, on page 94, in the course of the same article just quoted, after advocating a general division of the public and of public school money among such religious denominations as might desire such divisions, then the writer goes on to say, "But we're asked what shall be done with the large body of citizens who are neither Catholic nor Protestant. Such citizens," we reply, "have no religion, and they who have no religion have no conscience that people who have children are bound to respect. If they refuse to send their children either to Hebrew schools or to the Catholic schools, or in fine to the Protestant schools, let them found schools of their own at their own expense." In other words, let us of the various churches, Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, combine our forces and inflict upon all who cannot honestly and will not hypocritically join some church exactly the same kind of wrong under which we ourselves have been groaning for a long series of years. And if the editor of the Catholic Review refers to noises like these, we fully concur with him in his intimation that such noises were well calculated to prevent other people from perceiving the evil result of our public school system. But if Catholics will wisely maintain these great principles of human liberty and of equal parental rights without regard to differences upon questions which concern either politics or religion, there is no danger but that they will find a ready and cordial response on the part of intelligent and honest people, whether they belong to any church organization or not. Now, that was Zach Montgomery's castigation of the Catholics in trying to go it alone against the public school system. At least so he said in New York City. Now, the Roman pontiffs of the parental rights of the non-Catholics, the equal rights of Catholics, Protestants, Jews, and pagans, are upheld. The following extract from a sermon of Right Reverend Bishop Cameron, delivered at the laying of the cornerstone of a new convent at Sydney, is copied from the Cleveland Catholic Universe of November 6, 1884. In defining the position of the Church on this question of parental rights in educational matters, the learned bishop says, "Her principle and practice in this matter were admirably illustrated in the 13th century when the popes were in the very zenith of their temporal power and influence, and Innocent III ruled the world from the chair of Peter. Certain zealots proposed that the infant children of Jews and Mohammedans should be forcibly taken away from their parents, baptized, and then educated as Catholics. How was the proposal met? Well, Thomas Aquinas, the prince of the theologians, repudiated such advice as a wicked innovation. And he urged that such was not the usage of the Catholic Church, and that there had to be powerful Catholic sovereigns, and the Constantines and the Theodosii, who had many saintly and enlightened prelates, like St. Sylvester and Ambrose, to advise them all, and that such faithful bishops would not have neglected to recommend the proposed plan, had it been comfortable to reason. And he further proved that it was repugnant to natural justice, nature, having made the child a thing belonging to the father, the author of its being, and that child therefore ought to remain under the parent's care and control until it should attain to the use of reason. Hence, it would be manifest injustice to withdraw the child in the meantime from the parents, or to do anything to that child against the parents' will. But when the young person has attained the use of his free will, he is then his own sui juris, and is to be led to the church not by violence, but by persuasion." Such was the unanswerable logic with which the angel of the schools, the wonder of the ages, and the admiration of his own, utterly discredited and proposed encroachment on parental rights, and upheld their inviolable sacredness. Now, in the best period of Roman society, we're told that the state presumed not to pass the threshold of the Roman father. With any educational code in hand, though it did, at a later and worse period, attempt to enforce the Tyrannous and novel system imported from captive Greece, which gradually changed and then disfigured the fair face of Roman life. But hostile as was the Roman Empire before its conversion to Christianity, it did not seek to educate the children of Catholics in paganism or to prevent Catholic parents from bringing up their children in their own religion. Even when Julian the apostate closed the imperial schools to Christian teachers and forbade Christians to study the pagan classics and philosophy, he never encouraged the kidnapping of Christian children and the educating of them in the religion of the state. That is a refinement which exclusively belongs to modern secularism, utterly at variance both with Christian tradition and with the sacredness and inviolability of parental authority. Representing the temporal order, the state, whether pagan or Christian, has the right to look after the material wants and interests of society, not after men's minds, ideas, intelligence, motives, and consciences. The Christian state is bound to use its own powers according to the Christian law, but the Christian law gives it no power no additional power whatsoever. And that's because all of the power that it has is the power that belongs and is belonging to all states, whether pagan or Mohammedan. A pagan prince loses no right by his baptism, and neither does he gain any new right by that baptism over his subjects. As well, then, might you hold that Nero, Diocletian, or Julian the Apostate had a right to educate their Christian subjects in the enormities of heathenism, as to maintain that the civil power has now the right to trample on the inalienable right of parents to educate their own offspring as their conscience may dictate. The state, therefore, can interfere in education only as a helper of those naturally charged with the education of the young, and consequently, its first duty in the community of mixed religions is that of strict impartiality with regard to the various churches, to employ its educational machinery to Protestantize the Catholic, or to Catholicize Protestant children, or to sap the religious faith of either would be an intolerable usurpation and an injustice. Such a course of proceeding would, instead of helping, rather hinder parents from educating their children according to their conscientious convictions. No, it can never be too often repeated that the state has no right to educate or to control education. For Christian states, as states, are not different from pagan states, both having the same end and the same matter for their jurisdiction. And who will presume to say that the pagan state ever had the right to control and direct the education of its Christian subjects? Who will presume to say that it had or has the right to mold Christians and Christians' minds, to discipline their understandings, to control their wills, to direct the whole man, and to fashion him after his own prejudices into a so-called good citizen. As a most admirable supplement to Right Reverend Bishop Cameron's sermon on parental rights, it affords us great pleasure to be able to present herewith an extract from a letter just received from Right Reverend E. O'Connell of Marysville, California. The letter was written from Baltimore during the late session of the Plenary Council and bears the date of November 27, 1884. He wrote to Montgomery. He said, "Some time ago I promised to furnish you with the exact words of the Pope forbidding the least pressure to be put upon non-Catholic children attending Catholic schools, but it was not until now that I was able to find the precise words. Quote, we forbid non-Catholic pupils attending Catholic schools to be obliged to assist at Mass or other religious exercises. Let them be left to their own discretion. Instruction of the Sacred Congregation of Propaganda, FIDE, 25th April 1868, transmitted to all the Catholic bishops of North America." Now, these are potent utterances in behalf of liberty which speak for themselves. And it's our firm belief, founded upon both reason and personal experience, that if all of our American Catholics, bishops, priests, and people, instead of clamoring for special school laws intended for their own exclusive benefit, would boldly and persistently proclaim to the world these broad and universal principles of parental liberty as the intelligible, inalienable heritage of Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Mohammedans, and free thinkers, they would soon find their voices heard and their ranks as the friends of educational reform swollen by tens of millions of those who are today numbered with their bitterest opponents. Well, I'm about out of time. But that brings us up to chapter 9. We'll take it up right there next time. Poison drops in the federal Senate. The origin of public schools in America, when we come back next time. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on the Internet. It's heard 7 days a week here in the United States. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.